This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. As a freshman in college, Robert Blamire started working for Indiana Senator Birch Bayh. He remained on his staff for the next 13 years. And even after Bayh was out of office, the two maintained what became a 52-year relationship. Bob Blamire, author of Birch Bayh, Making a Difference, joins us today to talk about the life and legacy of Senator Birch Bayh. Do you remember when Senator Bayh was in office? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We have Bob Blamire with us for the entire hour, so if you have questions or comments about the footprint Bayh left on the state and the nation, send them our way. Bob, thanks for being here today.
I'm delighted to be here, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Some of our audience may be intimately familiar with the name Birch Bayh, and some of us may be less so. Just to lay the foundation here, Birch Bayh was a member of the Indiana General Assembly from 1954 to 1962, and then he went on to serve as a Democratic U.S. Senator from Indiana from 63 to 81. When did you first become part of Bayh's orbit?
Well, as I knew nothing. I was not a part of a political family. Mm. My father was a firefighter. I grew up in Hammond, Indiana, and I was interested in government and politics, so I applied for and got into George Washington University in D.C. When a friend of my mother's told us it was three blocks from the White House, that was my whole decision. I want to go there.
Fair enough.
And the first day after my parents left town in D.C., I took a bus down to Capitol Hill to offer my 18 years of life experience to the junior senator from Indiana, who I knew his name. My father had been part of the firemen going to Indianapolis and lobbying, and he was impressed by him. And but I didn't know a lot about him. He had been in the plane crash with Ted Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I was a huge Kennedy fan. I was like a lot of my generation who, when John Kennedy was elected president, you know, we got interested in politics and government in Washington, D.C. And so the fact that he had been in this plane crash with Ted Kennedy and saved Kennedy's life, that was pretty cool. And he was the guy I thought I would want to work for. So I went down there and I had the good fortune that day of meeting him. He had an open house and chatted with him. First time I'd ever seen a United States senator, much less met one. And he spun me off to a staff guy who took my contact information down. I think there was the phone in the lobby of the – or in the hallway of the dorm I was in. Ended up calling me a few weeks later and asked me if I wanted to participate in a project they were working on Saturdays. So I would come in with two other GW students, and we'd work on this project. And eventually they fell away, and I got on the payroll. And in fact, when I got on the payroll, I had to split the first pay with them. And I still have the pay envelope for $23 that I had to split with the other two guys.
You still have it. You kept it.
But that's – I got my foot in the door, and that was the only place I wanted to be.
Yeah. And here you are all these years later, and you've authored his biography. Was that something you ever imagined doing?
No. No. In fact, it first came up. He had and his wife were having dinner at my home and with my now ex-wife. And when they left, she turned to me and she said, "Kitty – asked me whether you would ever consider writing Birch's biography." Now, that was kind of – I'd never written – I'm a big reader of biography and I'm a big history buff. And clearly I know a lot about his life and career. But I called my brother-in-law who has written a number of books. And at the time I had my own company. And he said to me, you know, if you're going to keep your day job, you're going to have a hard time writing a biography. And – so we talked about finding someone who might be willing to do it and able to do it. And there was a guy named Ted Widmer, who actually has written a blurb in the book for me, who had worked with Clinton on his memoirs. And we invited Ted to have lunch with us. And Ted said to me, well, I'm committed to writing another book. I've got a contract, but I'd sure like to meet Birch Bayh. And so the three of us had lunch. And Birch said, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it myself. I'm not looking for anybody to write my biography. I'm going to do it myself. And I kept saying to him, yeah, I don't think you are. And this went on for years. Well, Ted Widmer fell in love, basically, with him. And right away wanted to make sure that this was done. And he ended up setting up a program at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, for Bai to come and teach. And that was how they ended up eventually moving to Easton, Maryland. It was because of this program. But we would keep getting together, and I would keep bringing up the subject. And then I told him one day that I had done – the best thing I felt I had ever done in my life was I had done a series of video interviews with my parents over a period of 7 years. And they told their entire life stories, my siblings, mine, and since then my father had died. So I said, you know, now they're priceless. How about if I do that with you?
Oral histories.
Yeah, video interviews. And, you know, he just stood there and said, yeah, I'd be willing to do that. And that's how it started. And he took it very seriously. We started – I would send him an outline. I would – you know, he was very active on email. I would send him an outline of what I wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. And we would schedule usually a weekend. I would go out there and spend 3 hours with him. We'd do these 30 interviews. He would ask me, is this shirt all right and where do you want me to sit? And he really took it seriously.
Yeah.
And we did 30 hours of it. Wow. Over the next 2 years.
Starting about when?
2012.
All right.
And we did 12 sessions over the next 2.5 years and 30 hours. And then I expanded it to do Evan and Luger and Lee Hamilton, and then a whole lot of former Bai staffers and other politicos around the state. I ended up having – I've cumulatively 60 hours of video interviews. And somewhere in that process, in that period, I got the contract from Indiana University Press to write the book. And, you know, it's, I think Birch was immediately pleased. And my original title that was going to be Making a Difference. This book is called Birch Bai Making a Difference. Mm. There apparently are 200 books that are called Making a Difference. And so the press didn't want that to be the title, even though – he says it repeatedly in the interviews. That's why I got in this business, was to make a difference. And so I wanted that to be part of the title. And he was able to read the entire first draft of the book.
Ah, well.
But didn't get the final version.
Well, no, but – so he was first elected to office in 1954. When he won the election to the Indiana House of Representatives. And 4 years later, in 58, he was elected Speaker.
At age 30.
And he was the youngest person to hold that office in the state's history. And you talk about his ability to connect with older generations in the book. And where did that ability come from, and what value did it bring to his career?
Well, we talked about that. He said that it was really his father. He said, my father taught me to be respectful of my elders, basically. His father also instilled with him a lot of his feelings about women's rights. And his father was an educator and basketball referee. He still holds a record for refereeing the most Indiana high school championships.
Is that right?
Yes. And his name was also Birch Bai. And a senator used to say to me that I think I might have gotten elected that first time because people thought I was my father. You know, the same name. It's like a rather unique name, as you know. And I think really that was it. First of all, if you knew Birch Bai, he was as affable a human being as I've ever known. He really liked people. He really liked campaigning. I mean, it wasn't a struggle for him as it is for many politicians. You think of Richard Nixon, how awkward he was in public many times. Birch Bai loved being in public and loved hand shaking and, you know, back slapping. And it was just he was a natural at it. So he never had an issue getting along with older people. And I think the legislature was a great, great training ground for that and for getting things done.
What did he learn in that time in the Indiana legislature?
Well, he learned, number one, you don't introduce something. You want to know what's going to happen before you do it. You don't ask questions without knowing the answers. You don't introduce pieces of legislation that have no chance. He found that you get things done by cooperating with people. And compromising.
You don't introduce something that has no chance.
Right.
That happens a lot these days. And it's symbolic because of the media cycle and the coverage things get. People will introduce things that have no chance just so they can say they did it.
That's true. Matt, you're putting your finger on what I think is one of the themes of the book. I often say the book is about two things. It's about, number one, an astonishing list of accomplishments for one person. But it's also about an era when things worked. Well, very different from the era that we're in right now.
Things were very different.
Very different.
Yeah. And so he, we'll go back to the timeline. He marries Marvella Hearn in 1952, and it's clear that he had no that she had no small influence on his career, from splitting up on the campaign trail to cover more ground, to the softer side of social engagements with other political families. Who was Marvella by, and can you talk about what their partnership was like?
Oh yeah, in fact, many people that knew them early. In my interviews, I was able to interview two of the remaining three people that had been the original Bi campaigners. Larry Conrad, Bob Boxall, and Bob Henshaw were the three employees in the Birch Bi campaign seeking the nomination in 1962. Larry Conrad, you know, has passed on some years ago. Bob Boxall, since I interviewed him. But both Boxall and Henshaw said in the interviews that had we been in a different era, Marvella very well might have been the candidate instead of Birch.
Is that right?
She was a farmer's daughter, only child of Oklahoma, had gone to Girls State and became the governor of Girls State for Oklahoma, and then the president of Girls Nation, went to the White House, met President Truman in the White House. Very accomplished. He met her at a speaking competition in Chicago in which she won. He came in second. But as he often said, I lost the contest, but I won the girl.
So this was a real political
partnership.
She
was a real deal. She was very articulate, very pretty, articulate, smart, much more of a perfectionist than he, much more demanding than he. He was much more laid back. He's the kind of guy who would lose his wallet. And I used to talk to him about he owed me for all the handkerchiefs that he lost of mine over the years, that I would loan him a handkerchief and I never saw it again. Very, very much laid back about that. Marvella never. Totally buttoned up, totally ready to go, absolutely organized and aggressive, both of them aggressive. And both of them love public service.
And we got just a little bit of time. They decide to run for Congress in 1962. John F. Kennedy, as you say, was president. There's momentum around youthful leaders. But there's a pretty big problem in the simple vein of name recognition. How did they solve that problem? We've only got about 15 seconds.
Well, the song. They came up with a song.
The song.
Popular song, Hey, Look Me Over. The words were put to it by Mary Lou Conrad, and it became the main memory people have of the 62 campaign.
Can you sing it real fast?
Hey, look me over. He's your kind of guy. His first name is Birch. His last name is By. Candidate for senator from the Hoosier State. And the rest of the words are in the book.
Bob Blamire, he's the author of Birch By, Making a Difference. Up next, we'll talk more about the late Senator Birch By, and we'll take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Before we get back to our conversation on the late Senator Birch By, I want to tell you about our last show. Yesterday, we talked about the NCAA's decision to begin the process of allowing college athletes to profit from name, image, and likeness. We spoke with an economist, a representative for college athletes, and others about how the industry and the players within it might be impacted. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In Indiana. Today, we're talking about the life and legacy of Birch By, former Indiana senator. And as always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we're joined by Bob Blamire, author of the biography Birch By, Making a Difference. Bob, thanks again for being with us today.
Delighted to be here.
And there was another hurdle in front of By in that same 1962 race against Homer Capehart. Mm-hmm. The Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, mm-hmm. is what we're talking about. How was By's fate tied to the crisis?
Well, first of all, Homer Capehart had been in one of the biographies of John Kennedy written by Ted Sorensen. He talks about how his least favorite colleague in the Senate was Homer Capehart, or the man he hated the most in the Senate. And Capehart and Kennedy did not get along at all. And Capehart had been calling early on, once it was known that Fidel Castro announced himself to be a communist, Capehart was insisting that we invade Cuba. So he was calling for the invasion of Cuba long before the missiles showed up. So when the missiles showed up, which was shortly after JFK came here to endorse By and at a rally at the airport, and made some snide remarks about the armchair admirals and generals who would send our boys off to war, sort of a backslap to Capehart. The following weekend, was what they call Black Monday, where it was announced that there were missiles in Cuba. And it looked like Capehart was prescient, like he had, and he kind of stopped campaigning. He had been telling us Cuba was a problem and we should nip it in the bud before it became a problem. Here now it was a real problem and the country seemed on the brink of nuclear war. What happened, though, is, as you know, with the quarantine that Kennedy put on and it turned out to work, Kennedy was very much a hero. And so the whole campaign message became support the president, vote for Birch Bayh. And he eked out a 10,000-vote victory. It wouldn't have happened if the Cuban Missile Crisis hadn't turned out the way it was and if Kennedy hadn't been so popular at that moment, there's no way he was going to beat Capehart.
So let's jump into the accomplishments of Senator Birch Bayh and the ways that we still feel the impacts of the work that he did while he was in Washington. I hear that it was a challenge to kind of condense everything that was worth talking about into one book.
Yeah, you might say that. It's a long record. And I can also be very wordy in describing stories relative to it. But his becoming the Subcommittee of Constitutional Amendments chairman in the Judiciary Committee is what really changed his life and the trajectory of his career. And that in itself is a pretty good story because it underlines some of the differences between the way things work now and the way things worked then. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee was James Eastland of Mississippi, who a lot of us might have said that had it been allowed, he would have been a slave owner, a plantation owner. I mean, he was the typical Southern barren, cigar-smoking racist.
Yikes.
And Birch is a member of the Judiciary Committee. And Estes Kefauver, the senator from Tennessee, dies, and he's the chairman of the Subcommittee on Constitutional Amendments, which have been fairly dormant. The 24th Amendment had passed to outlaw the poll tax. And otherwise, there wasn't a lot of activity going on. And Eastland was resolved to dissolve the subcommittee to save money. Mm. He was under command by the chairman of the Appropriations Committee to cut back on excessive number of subcommittees. Birch was the only member of the committee who didn't have a subcommittee. So he scheduled a meeting to meet with the chairman to ask him if he could get the subcommittee. And it was after work. And Bob Keefe, who was then the administrative assistant in the office, told me in my interview with Bob about that evening. He waited while Birch went over to Eastland's office, and it was several hours. And Eastland had a tendency to pour a lot of Chivas Regal in the course of these late evening meetings. Mm. Birch was not much of a drinker. And Bob Keefe said to me—
But he was polite.
He said it was the only time before or since he ever saw him drunk.
Oh.
He came back to the office, and he said, "Did you get the subcommittee?" And Birch said, "Nope." And the next morning, Eastland called him and said, "Birch, I think you'd make a splendid chairman of the Subcommittee on Constitutional Amendments."
So he did.
He got it. But it was, again, the affability, sitting and having the social interaction with this chairman, who was a fair chairman, not the kind of guy that we would admire, particularly now, but then, and he gave Birch the subcommittee. And then the Kennedy assassination came around. And mm-hmm. and the issue was that here we now have a president, Lyndon Johnson, who had a heart attack. We have an office of the vice presidency is once again vacant, which had been many times in our history. And there seemed to be a logical demand to try to, number one, deal with that vacancy rather than go to the Speaker of the House, who was in his 80s, or the President Pro Tem of the Senate, who was in his 80s, I think 70s, 80s. They were all both up there. And also the question was came up, had Kennedy, when he was shot, physically survived but had no capacity to serve? There was nothing in the Constitution that allowed for the transfer of power to the vice president. Mm. So this could be a potential dilemma. And the idea was, so Birch basically brought to passage the 25th Amendment dealing with presidential inability, disability, and succession. And within 7 years of its passage, it was invoked twice.
Wow. Well, and okay, so let's get to that then. He's the only non-founding father to have authored two constitutional amendments, the 25th, which we just mentioned, and the 26th. And shortly after entering the Senate, he became chairman of the Subcommittee on Constitutional Amendments. And let's start with that 25th Amendment, which establishes procedures for an orderly transition of power. I guess we know the context that led to the realization that that needed to be addressed, the Kennedy assassination. And if we fast forward only 7 years from that date of ratification, what was it,
1974,
the amendment came in handy and it was invoked twice, like you said, and it changed the course of history. How did it play a pivotal role in Watergate?
Well, when Spiro Agnew's, the scandal around Spiro Agnew ballooned and he resigned in disgrace.
There was
now a vacancy in the office of vice president, which prior to the 25th Amendment would have remained vacant, meaning when Nixon's impeachment was imminent, and as we know now, a lot of Republican senators and leaders of the House went down to the White House to tell Nixon he had to go, that he was going to lose the impeachment vote, he was going to be removed, he resigned, knowing the office would go to Gerald Ford. But without the 25th Amendment, the office would have gone to the Democratic Speaker of the House, Carl Albert.
Ah.
Now, that's a big deal. For Republican senators to go down and tell the president, we're giving the administration to the Democrats. And so there was a smooth transition because of the existence of the amendment. No one could have predicted that. But under the amendment, Gerald Ford became vice president. And then when he acceded to the presidency, Nelson Rockefeller became vice president. So twice in the first 7 years of its existence, it came into play.
Wow.
So it's really kind of, that in itself is amazing. There have been, Matt, 11,000 attempts to amend the Constitution in our history.
11,000?
11,000.
Wow.
There have only been 17 constitutional amendments since the Bill of Rights. Two of them are his.
Wow.
So that in itself, forget everything else that was done, that in itself is an astonishing level of accomplishment. 26th Amendment lowered the voting age to 18 and expanded the number of people eligible to vote by great many millions, and affected a lot of people. He almost passed the Equal Rights Amendment, which did pass the Congress and failed to be ratified by the requisite number of states in the time allotted. And he almost passed an amendment to get rid of the Electoral College, which he called his biggest disappointment in his career. And think of how that would have changed our world had we gotten rid of the Electoral College. Mm.
Another piece of legislation that was passed in the aftermath of Kennedy's assassination was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Mm-hmm. The vote to pass the act had been held up by a filibuster, and Birch Bayh and Ted Kennedy hopped on a plane after that vote to head to the Massachusetts Democratic Party's convention. Who was on the plane and what happened?
There was a pilot. Well, what happened was originally the president's Kennedy family plane, the Caroline, was at National Airport to take them all to Springfield. Mm. And the vote kept being held up and held up. And so Joan and other Kennedy family members left early and the second plane was brought in. And Marvella decided to wait and go with Birch. And in fact, Birch and Ted had a phone call that was broadcast to the people waiting in the arena in Springfield, Massachusetts. Birch was to be the keynoter at the convention. This was to nominate Ted Kennedy for a full term on his own right. He was filling the unexpired term of his brother. And so there was the pilot, Kennedy's chief of staff, Ed Moss, and Birch, Marvella Bayh, and Ted Kennedy. And the senator said to me in the interviews, he's convinced that the pilot, if he hadn't had two United States senators on board, would have insisted that they not fly in the weather they were flying in.
Oh, really?
That the weather got really bad as they approached Massachusetts. And in fact, he thought they were in black, dark clouds when they were in fact flying into an orchard and hit these trees.
Wow.
And in fact, if they hadn't hit the trees, they would have hit a sort of smallish mountain looming straight ahead. And the pilot was killed instantly. Ed Moss was Birch thought he was killed. He died at the hospital shortly thereafter. Mm. Marvella broke her tailbone. Birch had all his stomach muscles ripped and he had no use of one of his arms.
Wow.
And Kennedy, he thought Ted Kennedy was dead. He said they were sitting where Kennedy's back was facing the front and he was facing them. And he said Ted had just reached back to say something to the pilot when they hit. And the windows on the plane were structured to pop out on impact. And so they had. So they weren't like small windows that you have in an airliner. There are larger windows in this small plane. So Birch took Marvella and got her away from the plane. And then she started screaming that she smelled gas and didn't want him to go back. And he said he just had to. He had to see if anybody was alive. Mm-hmm. So he looked in the front of the plane and thought both of them were dead. And then he looked in and thought Ted was dead. And he said he noticed a movement of the fingers.
Wow.
And he kept yelling to him, Ted, Ted. And there was, he got a heard a groan. So he went and he said, I cannot tell you to this day how I got him out because he's bigger than I am. And I had one arm I couldn't feel. And he got him out through the window and dragged him out into the weeds.
And they were already close, Ted and, mm-hmm. and Vi. But this event really bonded them in an entirely different way, right?
Of course it would. I mean, and Joan Kennedy, for instance, would come to campaign here, as would Ted. And always talking about this, that I owe this man my life. It was – and there was a natural kinship in their style, their ages, their arrival around the same time. There were a lot of reasons and the philosophy, a lot of reasons for them to get along. But Kennedy came from a very different world than Birch Bayh came from.
Let's get back to policy. Okay. We see some similarity between the Equal Rights Act and Title IX, the civil rights law that Bayh would later become to known as the father of. Many know Title IX for its role in creating women's sports, but you call that more of a side effect, really, than a real intention. What's the central intention of Title IX?
The central intention – well, I go back one step where it came from. Marvella Bayh for years had complained to Birch that she had applied to University of Virginia. That was her life's ambition and got one of these letters, women need not apply. It was men only at the time.
Ah, so it was personal.
And she kept saying, how can they take federal money and be allowed to act this way? Mm-hmm. And Birch was the sponsor of the Equal Rights Amendment, and it was having difficulties at the time in 1972. And so he took the language out of that and put it in the Educational Authorization Act as Title IX that basically said, you take federal money, you can't treat men and women differently. It was more about that general equality of treatment, admissions. I mean, the number of women in law schools at the time was tiny. Medical schools, very few. It changed everything overnight that ways. Well, women's sports virtually didn't exist at the time either. And so that got created as well. But it was never the intention of the law. It's been the more public face of Title IX has been women's sports. You know, 21 of the 23 women in the World Cup recently, victory, had scholarships that didn't exist before Title IX. Mm. You know, so it's had a real impact, and it's probably something he's been recognized for more than anything else.
What about the cultural impacts that we still see today from Title IX?
Well, I think they're huge. I mean, just the fact that, you know, if you go to the universities and you see how many women there are compared to men these days, you look at the Olympics and how many women win gold medals compared to men. But I just think in society generally, the status of women was just moved up a notch really quickly because of the advent of Title IX. You see it all over in many ways. There's even a clothing store called Title IX and a magazine you can get about women's clothes called Title IX. It's had a far-reaching effect, something that no one anticipated.
Got a couple of minutes left. Let's circle back to the amendments that he had a hand in, which he helped to guide the 26th Amendment to passage, which lowered the voting age, as we said, to 18 across the U.S. And the student movement had fervently argued that if they were old enough to be drafted into a war they were against, they should be old enough to have a voice in their government. And this was an issue that Bayh had worked on before. What did this amendment mean to him?
It just made sense. You know, that you shouldn't be asked to go to war if you don't have the right to vote for the people who send you there. To him, that was a very simple premise. Senator Jennings Randolph of West Virginia had introduced the amendment 11 times in the Senate and failed each time. And it wasn't until Birch was the chairman of the subcommittee constitutional amendments that he introduced it and was able to bring it to passage. And it was ratified very quickly. The whole mentality in the country had changed. You know, the protests of the war, the activity of students around the country.
What was his stance on the war in Vietnam?
Well, he was a supporter of the war really up until, I would say, 1967, late 67, early 68, when he visited there. He came back with a whole different impression. He said that, you know, when you talk to the CIA people there and the reporters that were there and the less the top brass were totally supportive of the war, but you went under that and you had more conversations with people and you realized that things weren't going as well as they thought. Mm. And the tug and pull for him was that he was very close to President Johnson. And this was obviously a huge deal for President Johnson. Mm. He ended up coming out against the war in 1968, shortly after the Tet Offensive, which was right after his visit to Vietnam. Mm. And he said he struggled. This was not his style to come out against the President of the United States like this.
Got about 30 seconds mm-hmm. left. Well, I want to get to a comment from Facebook. Kyle writes, in the 1970s, Miles Davis traveled to Indianapolis to play a benefit concert at the convention center to raise funds for Bai's campaign. This was an unusual move for Miles Davis. How was he connected?
That's not totally accurate. First of all, I was there.
Okay.
It was Black Expo. It was not really to raise money for Bai, but he was there. And, I think we'd been part of the invitation. What I'd never forget about it is that after watching Miles Davis perform, he came out back and Birch reached out his hand and said, Miles, I want to say thanks for coming. And he said, I did it for the money.
Okay. All right. Well, that clears that up. There's lots more to talk about when we come back with Bob Blamire, author of Birch Bayh Making a Difference. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the impact of the Bayh-Dole Act. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now to our discussion with Bob Blamire, author of the biography Birch Bayh Making a Difference. Let's talk about a piece of legislation that bears Birch Bayh's name, the Bayh-Dole Act. You write that in 1980, quote, most new innovations were not being brought to market because of government patent policy. What was the problem with the existing patent policy?
Well, the patent policy said basically if the federal government had money in it, they had the rights to bring it to market. And the effect was they weren't being brought to market. Mm. There was really no mechanism in the system to bring them to market. So we were falling behind the industrialized world in new inventions, which had never, our history had been to lead the industrialized world. So this was just simply an effort to say, look, let's give the rights to the marketing rights to the small businesses or universities that took the lead on these things, regardless of the fact that federal money is involved. Mm-hmm. And it has had a huge effect on innovation and new businesses, more than $1 trillion of generated revenue, in vitro devices, 2,000 companies. I mean, and a company called Google who got created under the new rules that wouldn't have happened.
Wow.
So that you talk about a ripple effect in our world.
And so questions around government-funded research, who can profit from it and how innovations distributed became really personal to him. Mm-hmm. Marvella had been diagnosed with breast cancer in 1971.
Yes.
How did that?
I took her to the hospital.
You did?
Yes.
How did that affect his perspective?
Well, a lot, because when they would, you can imagine the frustration when he's in a good position to be able to contact anybody about her health and her treatments. Mm-hmm. Being a United States senator gives you access to anybody you want, really. And they're finding there are certain treatments and medicines that aren't available. They've been discovered, but they're not out there. They're not being produced. And we had some professors actually from Purdue had come to the office and talked about things they were involved in. That
Purdue certainly benefited a lot from the Bayh-Dole.
Yes, but this before Bayh-Dole, Purdue brought it up. They said we did these things and now nothing's happening with them.
Sure.
And so it really unleashed a huge industry of new developments and particularly in the field of medicine, which was the original motivation that Birch and Marvella had. When we look at how the world has changed since, I mean, in those days, the fact that she survived, for 7 years having had breast cancer was really unusual. Nowadays, the C word isn't, the cancer is not the death sentence it was then. And a lot of that is because of a lot of the new innovations and medical treatments that have been developed. The interesting story about Bayh-Dole was how it came about. It really came about as a parting gift for his losing. Mm. Senator Russell Long, the Finance Committee chair, had killed it constantly, called it the worst piece of legislation he'd ever seen. And then when we lost the election—
Did he have what was the reasoning?
He just felt that the federal government, if we're going to put money in it, the cost is that we have the rights.
Okay.
He didn't really focus on the fact that I couldn't really get into telling you why, because I don't know. I can't speak for Russell Long. But effectively, he hated it.
Okay.
But not enough to – that after the election was over, he basically called Birch and said, we're going to miss you here. That bill you and Bob Dole have on patent, it's yours.
Okay.
And it passed because of that. And the economists call it the most inspired piece of legislation in the second half of the 20th century.
Differing opinions.
Yes, very different opinions. And I think that I think it's really hard now to argue it was a bad idea. I think it's, that would be a really tough article.
It would be a very different world had that not come around. Okay, so let's jump to prayer in school. That was a hot topic during Bai's time. And there was serious debate over whether or not prayer should be part of the school day. And this was a topic that Birch Bai's thoughts evolved on. And these days, you know, someone's perspective evolving can be seen is often seen as a negative. They're called a flip flopper or any number of other things. Can you talk about that evolution?
Yeah, it really goes to his philosophy of being a representative. He said, you know, my job is the average citizen doesn't study the issues. They don't spend time learning about the details and nuances of the debate. They have feelings, but your job as a representative is to be the one who learns, who studies and makes a judgment. And you want the people, you want to make the judgment on their behalf, knowing full well that if they don't agree with you, they can vote you out of office. But Edmund Burke's philosophy was it is your job to be the one who studies and learns the issues and then vote your judgment, not what you think is what the people want, but what you think is right. And that became very firm in his philosophy over the years. Prayer is a good example of how that change or that philosophy basically was enforced, because his first reaction when the Supreme Court ruled that the prayer that was being conducted, you know, challenged in the court was unconstitutional, he felt, this is crazy. I mean, Evan starts every day at school with a prayer. We pray before meals. What's wrong with this?
Sure.
But the more he looked into it, he realized these were government-sponsored prayers. These were institutions telling people how they should pray, whether they should pray. And that's really not the role of government. And it took him a while because he felt that it was his political suicide at the time. Because here he is, the chairman of the Subcommittee on Constitutional Amendments, and Everett Dirksen, the Republican leader, is introducing the prayer amendment. And Birch ended up opposing it. And he felt when he came out in opposition to the prayer amendment, and he felt that the government has no business writing prayers, allowing institutions to write prayers to tell students, this is how you must pray.
Was it indeed political suicide?
It made life difficult. It obviously was not. He survived it because it was before, you know, he was reelected, twice afterwards. But it was at the time he said that when this came out, I felt that if I stand my ground here, I'm cutting my own throat. But he did it anyway.
What about presidential aspirations? He does throw his hat in the ring in 1976.
Oh, really? Twice. I mean, he almost did 4 years earlier.
Well, what kind of campaign did he run? How far did he get?
Unsuccessful.
Well, sure, of course.
Well, he started in 1971. Basically, he had led the opposition to two Supreme Court nominees by Nixon, Haynsworth and Carswell, in 1969 and 70.
Both I hope defeated, we'd get to that.
Both defeated. Never had happened before. And he started to develop a very strong feelings about the Nixon presidency. And he saw nothing on the horizon to convince him that Nixon would be defeated in 72, and started looking into doing it himself. And a lot of people were calling on him to do it after the national celebrity he got from these Supreme Court nominations. And we were putting together a campaign in 71 when Marvell's cancer was diagnosed.
Wow.
And so he dropped out.
Yeah.
In October of 71. So 4 years later, it came up again, and it was getting a lot of pressure to be one of the, you know, the liberal Democrats to try to run now that Gerald Ford is president and is clearly vulnerable. And so he entered – in many respects, early mistakes were made, strategic mistakes. Like I don't think – the campaign – he was not ready to win in Iowa and New Hampshire and entered both. When we started our campaign in October of 75, it was really the beginning. It wasn't just an announcement of a campaign that was already in going on. It was really the beginning. So there wasn't enough time to put it together properly. Now, he came in right behind Carter in Iowa. None of the above won in Iowa. Carter was second. Bai was third. And then New Hampshire, he came in third behind Carter and Udall. And then he got blown out. And so it was a campaign, I think, that made some really major mistakes early on. When the campaign manager was hired in December of 75, there was no finance plan. There was no reporting plan. There were so many things that were not done well. And it was one of these things that if you're going to do it, you have to decide earlier. He was bone-tired from the 74 reelection campaign.
Sure.
In 1975. It was hard to recover from that. That was the year we ran against Richard Lugar.
Mm.
I traveled with him throughout that campaign. Know full well how tiring it was.
Along those lines, we have a question from Stephen on Facebook. He asks, did Senator Bai regret withdrawing from the 76 presidential race and then endorsing Jimmy Carter? He goes on to say, I was living in Iowa that year, and I remember Bai making a strong showing, third after uncommitted and Carter in the caucuses. And later on, when liberal Democrats launched the ABC, Anybody But Carter movement, Bai might have been able to take the nomination.
I don't think that was going to happen. I think that the fact that he did so poorly in the Massachusetts primary and was really wanting to hold off for New York. We thought we had things put together really well in New York, but it was there were a lot of people running. When you lose as badly as we did in Massachusetts, the money starts to dry up really fast.
Mm.
And so it wasn't there. And he basically thought there was no alternative but to get out. And when he endorsed Carter, it was simply because he said he saw the writing on the wall. Carter was going to win. I think his first choice, if he hadn't been running at the time, would have been, someone else probably. He never really warmed to Jimmy Carter that well. I mean, they worked together pretty well when he was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, but Carter was not his choice.
Mm.
Nonetheless, I don't think he could have stepped up and been the alternative. There were people like Frank Church and Jerry Brown and others at that point who were much more viable, even Hubert Humphrey, than Birch at the time.
Shortly after, not shortly after, a few years later in 1980, Bai loses reelection to the Senate.
I remember it quite well.
In a Republican landslide year, Dan mm-hmm. Quayle beat him after 18 years in the Senate. How did he take the loss?
You know, it was in many ways somewhat inspirational because it was one of those nights I'll never forget. We had a headquarters full of crying people,
mm-hmm.
very upset. And his remarks to the crowd were, how can I be upset? He said, I've been given 18 years to do exactly what I want to do. And not very many people can say that. And now I thank the people of Indiana for giving me an opportunity to practice law. And really, it was really very much uplifting that there was no finger pointing. There was no excuses. It was simply that, you know what, I've had a great run. Because I was hard emotionally. I mean, look, my 13-year career ended that day as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard, but it was very uplifting the way he approached it. And he, very much got into – started a new family, the practice of law. And then, of course, Evan got involved in politics. And from that point on, he figured this is now Evan's turn.
Mm. And what was life like for the senator after he was no longer in office?
Well, I think he enjoyed practicing law. I think he really enjoyed teaching the course at Washington College. He enjoyed having another son and wife. His son Christopher was born in 1982, very much after his career. I would say that he, if he were reporting back now, he would say he's had a great life since. He didn't really suffer disease or anything. He kept his health for most of the time right up to the end of his life at age 91. You know, it was hard. And he stayed in touch with a lot of people that were involved, people like me. I'm certainly not the only one, but I value the relationship. You know, and a lot of people that were in our office have gone on to do a lot of great things. In terms of the legacy of people that went on there. Right now, there's a project going on, for instance, here called Indiana Citizen, run by a former Bai staffer named Bill Morrow, which is really to increase public awareness of the issues, the candidates, how to vote, to try to help pick up the number of people that are voting, to increase civic engagement. That's the kind of thing that he would be 100% behind right now if he were here to do that. We've had, you know, one of the former staffers was Biden's chief of staff and Gore's chief of staff. We have another one who became a billionaire who's spending a lot of philanthropic money in Washington, D.C. and around the country for various things. We've a lot of people that, and it made him really proud to know these things, as well as the fact that his son was elected to the seat he held in the Senate. He once joked that when he was at a Little League game of his son Christopher's, how I'm sure that I'm the only person in the country who is at a Little League game for one son while his other son's governor. You know, so it was an interesting life and a career that he was proud of. I think he would be proud of the book. I'd like to believe he would be, you know, in its final iteration. It's the reason I wanted to do this, and I think that I've had so much support from former by staffers is because we're all proud of the association and the accomplishments.
I want to touch on something that seems to be the big difference between the way politics were done then versus the way they are now. And I think everyone knows where we're going. It's this issue of you leave the work on the floor and then you can go and have dinner with the person you argued with.
Exactly.
And for a lot of reasons, that doesn't exist anymore. And a lot of reasons that kind of make sense. There's more media spotlight on it. And so you kind of have to, as a politician, be on all the time and be and stick to those principles in a very aggressive way in order to make people make it clear to people that that's how you feel. And the camera is in your face all the time. And so is the microphone.
And the iPhone.
And so the game is different now. But are there ways, do you think, that we could get back to that?
Yeah, it's a good question, Matt. I like to think that politics operates in cycles and things that swing one way come back the other way. But there are very distressing changes that affected this. The 24-hour news cycle would be one.
Sure.
The fact that everything you say these days ends up on social media somewhere, and so everybody, so it leads to a level of caution that didn't exist then, that you didn't feel like you were always being watched. But the whole concept that you can't get along with the opposition, that you can't be friends with the opposition, this was alien to him, was alien to anybody that served during that period, because the philosophy I think that era of politician had was today's ally could be tomorrow's adversary and vice versa. Compromise was not a dirty word. You go along to get along. And again, Bai's successes are marked by because he was able to cooperate with people like James Eastland, like the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, John McClellan, conservative Democrat from Arkansas. The fact that these men could get along and have dinner together later on. Ted Kennedy wrote about the picnics that would take place outside the Russell Senate office building at late night sessions. Now, these weren't Democratic picnics or Republican picnics. They were family picnics for the members. And you get, you know, it's hard, and it's hard to get along with somebody who's calling you names on television the night before. So this whole mentality of cutthroat, divisive politics is, you like to believe it's got to change. Mm-hmm. Can I tell you how it's going to change? I wish I could. I don't know how it's going to change. It is distressing.
There's a little bit more that you weren't able to put into the book. Where can people find it?
I have a website called www.blaymire.us. You got to be able to spell Blaymire, obviously. Blaemire. My editor said, you know, the beauty of this day and age is you put things out there for bonus features for junkies who want to read on.
He's the author of the political biography, Birch Bayh, Making a Difference. Bob Blaymire, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a joy. Thanks. Thanks, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show's engineered by Adam Gross. Tomorrow, we will run the interview we did with Tom Lobianco about the book about Mike Pence. This is All In.